Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Oftentimes, we will give preeminent treatment to the most dangerous threat we face as a nation, namely that posed by the Chinese Communist Party, now under the leadership of its newly coronated first Chinese Communist Emperor, Xi Jinping. A man who has studied closely and been, I think, perhaps the single most effective exponent of the argument that the Chinese Communist Party is our mortal enemy and must be treated as such, is, I'm very proud to say, a regular contributor to this program. His name is Gordon Chang. He's an author of numerous very important books, including The Coming Collapse of China and countless essays, often in Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute, and an incredibly prolific contributor to programs like this. And we're, as I say, very pleased to have him with us always, especially today when there's a lot to talk about. You can follow Gordon at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, and I strongly commend that you do as I do in following him there. Gordon, welcome back. It's good to have you as always.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Speaking of the Gatestone Institute, I want to start with a piece that you published there the other day in which you talk about what you call Biden's talking while Xi Jinping is preparing for war. This seems to me to be the essence of a problem that is of surpassing importance and real danger to us. Walk us through the evidence that notably in Bali, where the two met the other day, this is at work and very problematic indeed.
In Bali, at the G20 summit, Biden and Xi Jinping met on Monday. And afterwards, at his post-summit press conference, President Biden said, well, we don't have to have a new Cold War. And I felt that that really underscored how clueless the president is, because the Chinese believe that they are at war with the United States. You know, there's been decades of hostility, but it was crystallized in May 2019 when People's Daily, the most authoritative publication in China, carried a piece that in fact declared a people's war, quote unquote. And since then, the propaganda has been malicious and it's been relentless. But we're talking about a war in a different sense, because as you have often talked about, those two Chinese Air Force colonels wrote that book in 1999 with the title Unrestricted Warfare. And if we can just look at what China's been doing, China has been killing Americans with fentanyl. The Communist Party, which runs a total surveillance state, knows what these fentanyl gangs are doing, and it actually backs them. And these gangs run their money, their proceeds, through the Chinese state banking system. Well, that's 77,000, maybe 78,000 deaths in America from overdoses of illegal fentanyl last year. And we should consider each of those a murder. And we should also consider the Americans who have been, chemical warfare. And when we're talking about chemical warfare, we should also talk about biological warfare, because China deliberately spread COVID-19 beyond its borders. You know, Frank, I think that SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen that causes this disease, came from a Chinese biological weapons lab, but I can't prove it. But there's one thing I can prove to 100%, that Xi Jinping deliberately spread this disease beyond China's borders. He lied about contagiousness, and while locking down his own country, he pressured other countries, especially the United States, to take arrivals from China without restrictions. You put those two things together, and it shows that the spread of the disease, which has now killed 6.6 million people outside of China, that was deliberate. And that 6.6 includes 1,075,000 Americans who've died. Now, we can argue about the number, and people do, but any number above zero, to me, is unacceptable. So this is a war. And it's not just killing Americans. It's stealing U.S. intellectual property. It's trying to bring down our government. It's messing in our elections. You name it, China's been doing it.
And the trouble is that to the extent that we portray this as anything other than war, assures that we are going to fail to take the steps needed to treat it properly as just that. And this is, again, the disconnect, I think, that President Biden is well fostering as well as being subjected to. So, Gordon, I've written a commentary for today in which we talk about something that you've called attention to as well in terms of China's ambitions under Xi Jinping, namely that with the launch of this Artemis rocket that will advance, hopefully, our return to the moon, we're poised to pursue this for the purposes of, scientific knowledge and space exploration. The Chinese are determined to beat us back to the moon, I think it's fair to say, and may well do it, and that they have in mind not simply scientific exploration and the like, but colonizing the place and using it for military purposes, both on the moon itself, but also in this so-called cislunar space between the Earth and moon and on Earth as well. Our friend and colleague Rick Fisher has been warning about this for some time. You've called attention to it as well. Talk a bit about that as an example of, again, this disconnect and the dangers associated with it.
To put this in context, since 2018, Chinese officials have been talking about the moon and Mars as sovereign Chinese territory. In other words, part of the People's Republic of China. And they talk about openly excluding other nations from going to these heavenly bodies if the Chinese get there first and develop the capability to do that. We're not talking about these things, Frank. And, you know, it's not just President Biden. This is a disease in American political thought that crosses the political boundaries, crosses the aisles. And we have conservative Republicans, as well as Biden, who have these, I would say, uninformed views, if I could be polite about it, but they clearly are propagating narratives that the Communist Party likes. I'm not saying that they are communist agents. No, they're not. But they unintentionally advance Communist Party interests. And we have to have those candid conversations in the United States because, as I mentioned, this is across the political spectrum. We are not defending ourselves. The United States has, if you look at all the metrics, is a far stronger country than China, or virtually all the metrics. But we can lose our country because we're not defending ourselves. We don't understand the nature of the attack. Biden says, oh, we don't have to have a Cold War. Well, when Americans are dying, I call that a war.
No question. And many more are in the crosshairs, needless to say. And Gordon, to that point, I mean, you've suggested that we don't have Chinese communist agents in our government. I hope that's so. We certainly, however, starting with the commander in chief, have individuals who've been subjected to what's been called elite capture, compromised in the extreme. And our colleague, another of our dear friends, Trevor Loudon, has been documenting this exhaustively and calculates that there's, I don't know, 125 or so, including quite a number of senators, who are in this category. And that has to be a problem for a nation at war. Indeed, I would argue that it is an intolerable situation. And it's one of the other things I think we need to be exhaustively examining and rectifying if we can. Gordon, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you about another piece of all of this, namely the extent to which we are actually underwriting the Chinese Communist Party's war against our nation. We'll be right back with more with Gordon Chang right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden insists we are competing with the Chinese Communist Party. Actually, the CCP is at war with America.
And yesterday's launch of the Artemis 1 rocket highlights the ominous difference between these parallel universes. Our Artemis program is aimed at returning astronauts to the moon to advance space science and exploration. Chinese Emperor Xi Jinping is determined to have the People's Liberation Army get there first. Xi not only seeks to achieve national prestige by winning a space race, he's pursuing decisive military advantage by dominating the so-called Earth-Moon system. So, Beijing plans to build military installations on and project power from the lunar South Pole, affording China the ability to determine not only what happens on the moon, but on Earth and the space in between. This is no competition, it's war, and America must not lose the high frontier. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with the great Gordon Chang. Follow him at Gordon G. Chang, also at Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute, and of course, here just about every week. We're always proud to have him with us. Gordon, I think you wanted to respond to my comment about the compromise of our elites by the Chinese Communist Party.
Frank, the Communist Party does have agents in the U.S. government, and we have to be concerned that they are actively working. What I was saying was that there are many Americans, and not just liberal Democrats, also conservative Republicans from the Midwest, who have these narratives that are in line with the Communist Party's narratives. And I'm not questioning their loyalty. What I'm saying, though, is that they are furthering China's assault on the United States unintentionally. And that's, we need to have this perception that the United States is under attack, China's attacking us, and that we've got to defend ourselves. And that, for instance, conservative Republicans who believe in free trade are actually furthering China's theft of U.S. intellectual property and other crimes.
Well, let's turn to Wall Street, where you see people similarly aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party's agenda, including people like Larry Fink of BlackRock, and we'll be talking more about him with Bill Walton in due course. But you've written a very important piece at Newsweek, Gordon, recently, concerning what Larry Fink and his ilk are doing to have the investment funds, the retirement savings funds specifically, of the personnel of our government, including military personnel, invested in Chinese Communist Party companies, some of which are actually working for the People's Liberation Army, building weapon systems with which to kill those men and women in uniform, and perhaps others of us as well. What on earth is going on here, and what are the implications of it?
Yeah, this is the Thrift Savings Plan, which is essentially a 401k for federal employees. It was started for civilian employees, but since 2001, members of the uniformed services can participate. And as Roger Robinson, who has been leading on this, has pointed out, there are 35 companies in the international fund of the TSP that are Chinese. And in the mutual fund window, there are hundreds of Chinese companies, including those that have been put on the Commerce Department's entity list. This means that members of the uniformed services are investing in Chinese companies that are developing the weapons that Beijing intends to use to kill American service people. This is beyond inexplicable, and it's got to end. And whether we're talking about BlackRock or Blackstone or any of these funds, this is just not right. I mean, and it's not just TSP. We should be banning every American investment in every Chinese company. Now, people may say, well, if the company is civilian, what's the harm? The harm is that there's no civil military distinction in China anymore of practical consequence, because every civilian company is being mobilized to support the Chinese military. We see Communist Party cells in private companies, all the rest of it. We need to consider all of these Chinese companies as a threat to the United States.
Gordon, this is wrong on so many different levels, and I think you've made the key argument, of course, that it's obscene, really, for military personnel to be funding our adversaries' growing capacity to kill them. But there's also this question of, are we likely to see Americans who are invested in China, and in many cases, I think it's unbeknownst to them. Certainly, I think it unlikely, given that the board that oversees the Thrift Savings Plan, the so-called Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, has made no effort, in fact, has explicitly rejected the idea that they have any responsibility to tell their participants in the Thrift Savings Plan where their money's going. So, you know, they would almost certainly be unwitting. But so are an awful lot of other investors whose 401k plans or mutual funds or exchange-traded funds or index funds or what have you are similarly being sluiced by denizens of Wall Street who are making good money themselves, to be sure, on commissions, and seem not to be as mindful of whether there's real return on investment for their clients, to the point where, in fact, they may absolutely lose everything in the event this war becomes even more violent, even more kinetic than you've just described. Is that not right?
Certainly. You know, this is, and I think what needs to happen, Frank, you know, clearly Wall Street is in, this is very much on China. It's for reasons which I think are wrong, but nonetheless, investment reasons which I think are wrong, but nonetheless, what we need to do is have the American people force Wall Street out of China. And this is something that we can do because public attitudes on China are changing fast. And across the political aisle in Washington, we're seeing a growing consensus because they're starting to realize the danger. This is going to take time and it's going to be a battle, but we need to force TSP out of China. We can do it. The question is, can we do it fast enough?
Well, and again, I think that can be accelerated if people who check with their brokers, check with their fund managers, check with other Wall Street, you know, experts as to whether their money is invested in China, say, I want it out of there, and call on their managers and so on to make sure that that happens. And failing that, this could go very bad very quickly. I'm told that Wall Street is simply not putting more money willingly into China at this moment, that things are beginning to really dry up there. But if you've got money there now and stand to lose every dime of it, if you're not careful, you should be making, you know, haste to get it out, I think, as well. And Gordon, to the extent that something else that you touched on here is operating, the so-called PCAOB, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, is now trying to kosherize, if I can use that expression, something that, as a result of a memorandum of understanding actually initiated with the help of Joe Biden when he was vice president of the United States, that essentially said, American investors aren't entitled to know about the actual financial status of these companies they're invested in. That's all supposedly now being remedied by having accounting operations in Hong Kong doing some kind of review. Do you find, given what's happened to Hong Kong under Xi Jinping in just the past 2 years, that that's likely to produce the kind of credible audits that would enable investors to understand really whether they're buying pigs in poke?
Yeah, I don't think so. But Frank, there's a broader issue here, and that is that there should not be two set of rules, one for China and the other for everybody else. That's just wrong. And I think that Chinese companies, I mean, they have to subject themselves to the same rules that other companies do for the privilege of listing on American exchanges. So regardless of whether this new arrangement works out, and we had U.S. auditors go over to Hong Kong in August, we don't know how effective that was, but I really don't care. I'm just saying one set of rules for all companies.
Yeah, that's obviously true. I think the question of whether or not they were able to operate with sufficient independence needs to be determined, and you're right. We'll know more about that, I'm sure, later. But your larger point, Gordon, special treatment for China has been deemed by them, I think it's fair to say, as just further proof of our submissiveness and their inevitable rise and dominance. And for that reason alone, this has to end, to say nothing of the possibility that a lot of us are going to get badly hurt financially. We have to leave it at that for the moment, sir. Thank you for your time, Gordon, your wonderful contributions to this program and to the common weal through your essays and books. Thank you for joining us each week, and we'll look forward to talking with you next. Right after this, we're going to come back with Yoram Edinger about the State Department's failings. Right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. We're going to turn now to the Middle East, a, well, problematic area on a very good day, and there aren't many good days in the Middle East. Usually it is a cauldron of violence and, not infrequently, serious threats to not only friends we have in the region, most especially the State of Israel, but to our own country as well. They emanate from a lot of different sources, particularly at the moment, and now for 40-odd years, from the Islamic Republic of Iran. A man who has had a very important vantage point and deep understanding of the region is a regular contributor to our program, I'm very proud to say. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He served in the Foreign Service of his native state of Israel with great distinction, including for quite some time here in the United States, among other things, as the man who was the liaison to the United States Congress, a critically important role in the Israeli embassy in Washington with the rank of ambassador. He writes the Edinger Report these days, and one of the pieces in that report caught our eye, and it seemed to me it was time to talk with him about it. It's about the systemic failure of the State Department with respect to Middle East challenges and personalities. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. I'm so pleased to have a chance to visit with you again, and thank you for this very important essay on an endemic problem, it seems, one that continues intensively under the Biden administration. Walk us through the history, if you would, and where we are now.
Well, thank you very much for providing me with this opportunity. First and foremost, the Middle East is very critical, not only to its own countries, but it is of utmost importance to the U.S. Itself, and not merely because it is a junction between Europe and Asia and Africa, between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf, a very critical intersection for global trade, the price of oil at the pump, for instance. But the Middle East happens to be, sadly, an epicenter of anti-American terrorism, which reaches all the way to the U.S. And when it comes to formulating policy towards the Middle East, the State Department has been systematically wrong. They have been systematically wrong, in my mind, due to the ambition to apply Western values and Western institutions to the Middle East, which is based until this very day, when it comes to the Arabs and the Muslims in the Middle East, it's based on a 1,400-year-old tradition of values formulating its domestic and regional and global policies. One example happens to be Iran. The Ayatollahs of Iran are perceived by the State Department to be amenable to good faith negotiation, to peaceful coexistence, to abandoning their vision in return for a financial and diplomatic bonanza. But the Ayatollahs of Iran follow a policy which has its roots in a very, very critical battle in their history, which took place 680, the Battle of Karbala, which for them has shaped their own martyrdom tradition and their own willingness to sacrifice their life and their own determination, not only to topple every single Sunni Muslim regime, but also to bring to submission every single so-called infidel Western regime, especially the great American Satan. The assumption that they are amenable to good faith negotiation contradicts their own history, their own track record. And from 1979, when they assumed power in Iran, largely because of a tailwind coming out of the State Department in Washington, where the U.S. stabbed the back of the Shah of Iran, who was the American policeman of the Gulf, and elevated to power the Ayatollahs of Iran. From that moment on, February 1st, 1979, till today, the U.S. State Department has enacted the diplomatic option, which has served as a major tailwind for the Ayatollahs' anti-American policy and a major headwind to the U.S., and all because of assuming that the Ayatollahs would be amenable to Western values, which has never been the case.
Mr. Ambassador, this is unfortunately only one example of the syndrome, I think it's fair to say, a particularly egregious one, as you rightly indicate, going back now over 40 years. Let's talk about another grievous mistake that the State Department has made, and in fairness, U.S. administrations, notably that of the Obama and Biden teams. namely the embrace of the Muslim Brotherhood, a Sunni Sharia supremacist entity that's sort of an alternative pole, if you might call it that, to the Shiites of Iran. The State Department has consistently thought that it was possible to imbue the Muslim Brotherhood with the idea that it is a peaceable, non-violent alternative to the jihadis. How would you characterize the Brotherhood, and what have we seen come from the Arab Spring, the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, and more broadly, what is still going on vis-a-vis the Brotherhood today?
Well, it really doesn't matter how do I characterize the Muslim Brotherhood. The key element is the track record of the Muslim Brotherhood, which where the movement was established back in 1928 in Egypt. And since its establishment, and especially since the 1960s, with the formulation of the current global policy of the Muslim Brotherhood, they have acted very smartly. They established a network of welfare organization, educational organization, political and religious organization next to the key element of the institution of terrorism. The aim of their terrorism has been to topple every existing national Islamic regime in order to establish a universal Islamic regime adhering to the most fundamentalist elements of Islam, and in the process, obviously, to bring the Western infidel, the USA, to submission. The fact on the ground has been that every single pro-American Arab Sunni regime has been targeted by the Muslim Brotherhood, most noticeably Egypt, and then the Saudis, and then United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, as well as Jordan. And by the way, they have been active not only in the Middle East, they have been active all the way to the Far East. They have been active in India and in Pakistan.
And in the United States of America itself, unfortunately.
And in the U.S.
deeply penetrating our government.
Absolutely, in Europe as well as in Africa. And again, the State Department, assuming that the political elements of the Muslim Brotherhood represent the vision of the Muslim Brotherhood, the State Department has aspired to cultivate good diplomatic ties with the Muslim Brotherhood in the process back in 2009, the U.S. started stabbing the back of Mubarak, the pro-U.S. Mubarak of Egypt, elevating the Muslim Brotherhood inside Egypt, which facilitated their rise to power in 2011, 2012, in a similar way to the U.S. stabbing the back of the Shah of Iran back in 1978-79.
And that was a dismal period when the Brotherhood ran Egypt, needless to say, dismal
absolutely
for the people of Egypt as well as for us. Mr. Ambassador, before we run out of time, we've got about a minute. Just quickly tie in this syndrome, as you call it, the systematic failure of the State Department with the Palestinian so-called peace process with Israel.
Well, that's another cause of concern towards the State Department, because the State Department has missed the point completely, assuming that the Palestinian issue has been the key formulating element of Middle East politics, the crown jewel of Arab policies, core cause of Middle East turbulence. But here we have, again, a track record. Four recent Israel-Arab peace accords with the United Arab Emirates, with Bahrain, Morocco, and the Sudan were concluded by bypassing the Palestinian issue and by bypassing the State Department,
exactly.
And therefore they came to fruition.
Exactly. Mr. Ambassador, we have to leave it at that. Thank you. This is a terrific insight. and one we need to base policy on, I think, not the admonitions of the State Department. God bless you, sir. Come back to us again soon. Bill Walton joins us for his update right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the War of Ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back, and a special welcome always to one of our regular featured guests here at Securing America. His name is Bill Walton. He has his own television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show, which I strongly commend to you all. He delves into topics that are of great importance and has fabulous guests on. I myself accepted, but on occasion I'm able to join him there. And
we got to get you back, Frank. Got to get you back on.
Love to do it. Always appreciative of him joining us here. Bill, a lot to talk about, drawing on your background as a Wall Street guy, especially, but also your insights from leadership in the conservative movement, notably with the Council for National Policy. I wanted to ask you about this so-called ESG movement, environment, social justice, I guess, governance is what it stands for. It seems that the bloom is coming off that particular rose.
Yeah.
Am I right about that? And how have we found ourselves in a position where it is operating at all in Wall Street, let alone in the banking sector, and having all kinds of consequences in our economy and businesses?
Well, ESG investing was always and forever a product of a bull market. And, you know, one of the big beneficiaries was Larry Fink at BlackRock, who saw their assets under management rise over $10 trillion. Maybe they hit $11 trillion. Well, anyway, with the bust in the markets and real pressure in the equity markets and the bond markets as well, they're beginning to sing a different tune. I mean, just to break it down, environmental, social, governance agendas for corporations were never about economics. I mean, you can break it into the pieces. The environmental piece basically meant abandoning fossil fuels and going into wind and solar. And if you're a gimlet-eyed investor, as I used to be, you look at the investing in that, then wind and solar don't work without massive government subsidies. On its own, it's got a negative return on capital. And so if you're running a company like a capitalist, an old-fashioned capitalist, you're saying you can't invest in that because it's what I would call uninvestable. The social piece, you've got all these different agendas going on inside corporations, critical race theory, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And they've built up massive bureaucracies inside big companies. Thousands and thousands of people making $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year. There's some DEI executives who are making close to $1 million a year. So you're layering in all these extra expenses for what? Certainly not to make a better widget or provide a better service. And then the third piece, the governance piece, well, there's been a big movement to bring people on boards of directors who bring a social agenda or some other some other deemed good
or socialist thing. Agenda, as the socialist, case may be.
There is that. But, you know, I think I mentioned this before. Back in my day when I was doing private equity investing, you want people on the board of directors who understand the business, the industry, who understand how to build organizations. Well, that's not the kind of people who have been recruited to boards of directors of big companies in the last 20, 25 years, and they don't know anything about the business. So ESG, when you look very hard at it, it's great if you're making money, the stock's going up, but if the stock's down 20, 30, 40%, you're all of a sudden asking that chief executive officer, what are you doing? Get back to business.
You know, there are a couple of overlaying themes here, Bill, and you've just done a really wonderful job of breaking down some of the specifics, but this whole idea of stakeholder capitalism as opposed to shareholder capitalism, well, certainly seems to be a function of if it's a bull market and everybody's making money, nobody really cares. But when it's actually own companies that are in trouble, it matters a lot, right?
Well, as a recovering CEO myself, stakeholder capitalism is terrific. And you know why? Because it can't be measured. I mean, if you're just looking at return on investment to shareholders, you've got a number you've got to calculate, which is the return on capital and maybe how much in the way of dividends you pay out, all very measurable. Stakeholder capitalism, which brings in all these other constituencies from the surrounding communities, it can't be measured. It's just sort of a nice thing we want to do. So you can go to your shareholders and say, well, we may not have made any money last year, but look all the good we did in our communities. When your stock price is down 50%, that's not a speech you can be very successful with.
You can pull off, yeah. Yeah. Bill, the other overarching theme, it seems to me, that you've sort of expressed is the departure from meritocracy. Merit in the companies, merit with respect to their governance, merit with respect to, you know, well, at the end of the day, performance as well. It all would seem to me to be standing on its head, basic business practices. And I would think people would be trying to get away from it like scalded cats. You know, the as you mentioned, the acronym is DEI, divestment. Diversity, equity, inclusion. I always thought that, you know, why isn't it DIE? Because that seems to be a better description of what they're doing to
let's kill all
our
the companies.
And economy. Yeah, yeah. Get away from merit. Let's kill all the business executive. But those kinds of overarching themes are redolent of the agendas of this radical left, whether it's taking out our energy sector or whether it's screwing up, you know, our businesses. It's not good for certainly the economy of the United States and arguably the people who own pieces of it.
Well, Frank, there are three or four or five big things you could do to turn America around. And one of them would be getting back to the notion of a meritocracy. I mean, the affirmative action and all the other ways that people are being measured, it doesn't reward talent. It rewards whether your skin color or your sexual orientation or whatever is the correct one. And if you put yourself in a position of a small business person running a company, maybe with 15, 20 people, you're not going to hire based on those metrics. You're going to hire based on what people can actually do in terms of helping you drive the business. Nice to hire people of you know, that are maybe different profiles, but the real thing is you got to run a business. And when you get into a big corporation or a university or any other institutions, that mission gets lost. And so we've got a lot of people on the job who are not the best people for the job.
And there's nothing to say that people who happen to have a different skin color or background or whatever can't have merit, but you
exactly.
want to be rewarding
exactly.
them for the merit, not because
go with
of
the merit first
things.
And then everything else will,
yeah,
will
the
follow.
Content of their character and all that. We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton right after this. We'll be right back. We're back. Bill Walton is in the house, and we're going to talk about China. But before we do, Bill, I do want to just tie this ESG stuff into the climate change agenda, which is much in the news at the moment because there are these seances taking place in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, under the rubric of the COP27 climate change conference. And, you know, the focus of it seems to be not only more of the histrionics about how dangerous climate change is and how we must bankrupt essentially economies, the Green New Deal and all the rest of it to try to prevent disaster from taking place. And on top of all of that, we need to have the developed world that has caused, we're told, climate change to transfer, by some estimates, trillions of dollars to the developing world, which is the victim of climate change. Walk us through what on earth is going on here, the science, if you can, but also, you know, the economic and other consequences of all this.
Well, Frank, you bring up the biggest single issue, the failure of our education industry. But that's a topic for another day, because these people are operating on blindingly stupid ideas. And you know, just take a simple fact. The fossil fuel industry has been incredibly helpful in terms of creating all the goods and services that have made the world vastly wealthier in the last 150 years. It's brought 2 billion people out of poverty in the so-called developing world in just the last 75 or so years since World War II. And, you know, we're witnessing all the wealth that's created from that, and now it's being attacked. And with the third world or the developing world, they're the ones that most want to use fossil fuels. They don't care about whether they're being nice about this or that. They want to enter the modern world, and you can't do that without fossil fuels. And so the irony here is that they're trying to get reparations from wealthy countries for the damage done to their countries because of climate change. In the first place, it can't be measured. I mean, we don't really know what climate is affected one way or another. So we're back to these metrics, which are all subjective and in the eye of the accuser. And so we have these ridiculous conferences. I don't know who pays for them, but they're all there arguing for reparation. Well, we do. Yeah, I guess we do.
I think it's the bottom line. But Bill, in fairness, people insist that climate change can be measured, and they're looking at, you know, polar caps changing and polar bears being, you know, suffered and all the rest. In point of fact, though, what remains, I think, undetermined is how much of this is a function of anything we do, as opposed to vastly more powerful forces that that nature causes. And in the absence of that being clear, this idea that, you know, we can bankrupt ourselves to try to make a difference on the climate, to say nothing of transferring enormous amounts of wealth, seems to me really very debatable at best, and at worst, you know, just lunatic.
I'm not as current with the statistics. I should bone up. But if you do all the things we're talking about, carbon emission, I think it changes the temperature in 30 years by 0.01 degree Celsius or something like that. And there are all these other factors that influence climate change, and we can't influence that.
Right.
And
those naturally occurring phenomena. But I was told the other day about a volcanic eruption underwater off the coast of South America that has markedly lowered the temperature.
But I want to make a positive point, Frank. I mean, the humans are amazing at adapting and innovating and creating and building. I mean, it's The Ultimate Resource. The Ultimate Resource is our ingenuity and our ability to adapt to change. And let's suppose the world does get 1 or 2 degrees warmer measured by Celsius. It's sort of so what, because we will have adapted. If the sea levels rise a little bit, we'll adapt to that. But also, a warmer world is a better world for human beings. The agriculture is much more flourishes much more, and so do people. Infinitely number of more people die from the cold than they do from the heat. So,
and carbon dioxide helps things grow as well, including forests and the
like. If you look at photographs of North America in the last 50-100 years, it's becoming greener and greener and greener. And that's a good thing. So
it is a good thing, especially since in Europe they are now clear cutting their forests for heat.
Well, they need the wood
for the winter. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that Bill, 12th century was a great place to get your fuel. Those ideas were great. Windmills
we may be back to
your forest. Yeah,
if these guys have that in mind. Bill, lastly and very quickly, we were talking earlier in the program with Gordon Chang about investing in China at this point, yeah, including the idea that federal employees should be induced, mostly unwittingly, to do just that through their federal retirement system, the Thrift Savings Plan. Just your current thinking on the advisability of putting another dime into communist China at this point.
Well, we've talked about this. There are a couple of ways that we do it. One is through the public markets investing in Chinese companies. But I think the bigger issue is how many American companies are in China. Kentucky Fried Chicken sells more chicken in China than they do anyplace else in the world. Starbucks is there, Nike, of course, Apple.
Starbucks is opening up a new store there, I think, every couple of hours, as I understand it. Dependent as a result on the China market.
Yeah. You know, you've accused me of a recovering Wall Street guy. Well, 10, 15 years ago, everybody was drinking the Kool-Aid, invest in China. You know, it's more efficient, blah, blah, blah. We'll bring China into the world. Well, that theory was wrong. And particularly with Xi, it's definitely wrong. So you've got a lot of American companies now that are in China. And the question is, what do they do? You know, then you've got people at a personal level. Steve Schwarzman, that runs Blackstone, has got something called the Schwarzman Fellows, and he's been putting tens of millions of dollars of his own money into China to develop what, in effect, is kind of a Rhodes Scholar program there. Steve's a pretty good guy, and I can't believe he's at all happy with the direction that Xi is taking this country. And there are a lot of guys that have made bets on China, personal and corporate, and I think they've got to be rethinking it. I hope they are.
Especially if it's with your money, needless to say. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you, my friend. As always, great work on the Bill Walton Show, and your contributions here are so appreciated. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us do just that. Until then, next time, go forth and multiply.